Welcome to the Novel Romantics Literature of Chicago podcast series at the Amerikazentrum Hamburg. I'm the host of Novel Romantics, Douglas Cowie. I'm a writer and teacher. In each episode of this 10-episode series, my guest and I will discuss a work of fiction set primarily in Chicago. For this episode, we will be discussing The Man with the Golden Arm by Nelson Algren, which was first published in 1949. And my guest today is Mark Blotner. Mark Blotner has worked on independent video productions ranging from community-driven documentaries to the 1997 BBC documentary A Walk on the Wild Side as a researcher and fixer. He has extensive history in corporate interactive design and development for a variety of distribution channels, including mobile, web, and desktop digital media. He co-produced the 2015 documentary film Nelson Algren, The End is Nothing, The Road is All, which is distributed by First Run Features, and which I highly recommend. Mark is currently working as an executive producer and director on the upcoming web series, A Progressive History of Chicago, and in his day job, he's a software engineer for a sports data company. The website that he designed and developed for the Nelson Algren film is nelsonalgrentheroadisall.com, and I highly recommend you check that out because there's lots of good stuff on it. Today we're going to discuss The Man with the Golden Arm by Nelson Algren, 1949 novel. Mark, you've made a documentary film about Nelson Algren. And so my question is, why Nelson Algren? What's so great about Nelson Algren to you?
Right. Okay. Why Algren? Well, here's my personal anecdote. When I first moved to the Wicker Park neighborhood, West Town, generally speaking, Chicago, I had a roommate who's a writer, and he turned me on to Nelson Algren's writing. And when I started to read The Neon Wilderness was the first book I read of Algren. And I think that's a good entry point for anybody. Short stories. It's a collection of short stories. In particular, How the Devil Came Down Division Street. It's my favorite short story of any literature, certainly of Algren's. And when I read Algren's writing, the characters, the way he described the characters, it basically made the neighborhood come alive for me. It was like I would walk down the street and I would see a building. I actually could visualize these people and hear them speaking and smell the food that was being cooked and the tenement life that was there. And there were vestiges of it left when I first moved to Chicago back in 1983. It's not so much the same now, but you could see and feel the history and understand what brought people to essentially the gutter and how they got to that point. And I think that's why Algren. I mean, Algren helps define essentially the human condition. That is the key, is that understanding people that may not be like yourself and really with a keener eye and a sense of empathy. That's why Algren.
That last thing, people who aren't like yourselves, is like, it's interesting to me because that, for me, Algren, all of his work is always about people who aren't even really like him and are not like the people who usually read novels. They tend to be quite articulate, badly educated people, very poor, like the poorest of poor people. They're often criminals. They're not necessarily nice people. And these are all elements of his fiction that, so to you and to me, I guess, are really what makes it great. It opens your imagination to a part of the world that you don't necessarily experience firsthand. And probably don't want to experience firsthand if we're honest with ourselves. But it's also what critics of Algren really seem to despise about Algren. That there was something, he was accused, one of the critics accused him of being the Bard of Stumblebum. And was it The Man with the Golden Beef?
Oh, Golden Beef. Man with the Golden Beef.
Yeah.
Yeah, Leslie Fiedler and...
And Pod Horitz and...
Norm Podhoretz, correct, yes.
But it's to me that it's interesting to me what you said about the fact that this reading, How the Devil Came Down Division Street, sort of opened up the very neighborhood you were living in a different way. And makes you think about, makes you look at your own city in a different way. And that empathy for those people that you walk past on the street.
Right. It certainly helped me to understand. At the time, there was still a Polish underclass that lived in the Wicker Park area. You know, I would come home at night, and there was a guy that I always find sleeping in my parking spot right in the gutter. And he had lost an arm. I don't know how he'd lost the arm, but he had obviously been drinking all day and just decided that somehow he stumbled into the street. I mean, easily could have been run over. And I just, you know, I just wonder, how did this happen to this person? How did he get here? This is the other thing, is there's not many other writers that really have done that in history literature. There's
writers who approach it, but don't quite go full commitment that Algren gives to these characters. And it's that question, like, how did this guy get here? Algren asks that question, but that's, for him, that's like possibly the least interesting question, or the only a preliminary question, because then the question for Algren, it seems to me, and we'll get to this in the specifics of the novel as we go, like, is really like, how do they survive? How does this guy survive here? What does it mean to live a life like this? And how is this life meaningful? I think Algren doesn't disrespect those characters. He genuinely empathizes, and he asks you to empathize with characters who you probably don't like and don't want to meet. So The Man with the Golden Arm is a novel about Frankie Machine, a card dealer, a war veteran who's come back from the Second World War with injuries and a morphine addiction. And it follows a story of him trying to get clean, trying to break out of a loveless marriage, trying to do a lot of things and being unable to do that. He's trapped in this in a variety of things, including being trapped on Division Street. He's trapped in that gutter, really. But it's always been interesting to me, reading and rereading this novel, as I have quite a few times now, that although that's the plot of the novel, that's the title of the novel, it really is a novel about the whole neighborhood. And it really, more and more, and the more I think about it, the more I reread it, I think the first half of the novel is constructed this way in particular. It's an ensemble piece. And Algren spends a lot of time with every single character in this novel. And you get to know a lot about even really minor characters. One of the ones that stuck out to me in this reread that I did this week was there's a character called Umbrella Man, who's like the kind of idiot brother of one of the cops. And he shows up and plays in the nightly poker game, and Frankie kind of keeps an eye on him and doesn't let him get ripped off, because everyone's trying to cheat this guy because he's a soft mark. And you end up learning quite a lot about him, even though he doesn't say a word in the novel. And he's kind of an important, he shows up at just important moments, and he's not there to be a metaphor, and he's not there to be a symbol of anything. He's there because he lives in the neighborhood, and he's part of the relationships of all these people. And that the Algren's great, one of the things that makes him great, and one of the things that I think excavates that empathy and that genuine belief in the humanity of these people who live desperately difficult and poor lives, is that he shows exactly how these people are all dependent on one another in different ways, and how those dependencies get valued and how they get broken. Because it's really when they get broken that people have their downfalls. And maybe this is a good place to pivot a little bit here, is how the power structures of the city or the country, the political power structures, how they clamp people down. Because that's really what happens in The Man with the Golden Arm. The thing that makes Frankie vulnerable is that it's an election year.
Right. Well, I'm just coming to pull back to the previous subject where the New Year's Eve party scene, where all the sub-characters there, but the way that Algren describes it, almost from the point of view of the gang, so to speak, is, you know, the bar gang. Everybody who mattered was there, right? And then there were people who didn't matter that were there, and of course they're not brought up in the novel. And then there's people who didn't want to matter. And I thought, well, that's Algren. He's sitting in the corner, you know, observing these folks. In their lives, he didn't, you know, he was just some background character. You know, he was, you know, they probably knew him as a writer to some degree, or I think he might have been known to some degree in the neighborhood, but he didn't matter in that story. And I think that's a very good scene because it shows them in the most positive light in that particular New Year's Eve party scene. And what he does so well is with these characters that have such tragic lives, and I guess to put it bluntly, the average American would write them off instantly as losers and no one to care about it, and not even waste any time thinking about. And the fact that, hey, you know, their lives matter too. They're people. They have their thing. And what's so amazing is Algren is able to bring that to light. You know, I mean, there's deep tragedy in, I think, almost every one of them. And to bring this forward to the power dynamic, absolutely. You've got so Frankie Machine is the dealer for essentially, I guess, a small-time mobster.
Yeah.
Who is tied Shifka. In with Zero Shifka. And the neighborhood politics with the superintendent, the ward super.
Yeah.
They usually call him the ward superintendent. So in Chicago, it's not quite the same these days, although there are certainly elements of it where the ward politics were very, it's identical to organized crime. It really is. I mean, it is, and quite often it's one and the same. So you have this hierarchy of whittled down to block by block, you know, the precinct captain. You have somebody that watches over your neighborhood, and somebody in an ideal situation, you're supposed to be able to go to them if there's a problem with the trash pickup, or, you know, a gang in the neighborhood that's threatening you. You know, go to the precinct captain, you tell them what's going on. Maybe the alderman will step in, bring some, you know, a little bit more police, alert over there. But really, the typical thing in Chicago is they might be part of the whole gang structure, right? So, you know, you couldn't have prostitution. You couldn't have the types of crime that we have in Chicago without the involvement of these figures, without the police being involved, right? Former alderman we interviewed for the film, Leon Dupree, brought that up very well. Leon Dupree was an alderman that, at one point in the late 50s, early 60s, he was one of the only dissenting voices in a very democratic machine-run city hall led by old Richard Daley. So the power dynamic, it goes way back in Chicago, and Algren captures it very clearly. You have everything down to even like Sparrow Saltskin, Frankie's sidekick, so to speak. They have the power dynamics on the block and small petty thievery. Who's in charge of that? So nobody else would be dog thieving in the neighborhood because that's Sparrow's job. Yeah. That's what he does. And Frankie's the dealer. Nobody else is going to be in that slot. Nobody's going to be the card dealer. You know, Frankie's the man and works for Shrivka. And of course, they're tied in with the local politics. And that's in the end, of course, that's what.
And Nifty Louie and Blind Pig are the drug dealers, and everyone knows that. And they stay in the bar across the street, out of the way of the Tug and Maul, where Antek is the barkeeper and sells beer and whiskey, and only beer and whiskey. And no one bothers the cops don't bother the drug dealer because they know who he is, and he's tied into them as well. And then you have the landlord, who, as long as the doors are shut in the building, won't give you grief, but he wants everything kept behind closed doors. Then you've got all the people living their different lives in that tenement building. So Frankie and his wife, who's a invalid, Zosh. You've got Vi and her husband, Stosh, who's an old man who doesn't speak very much English. He's Polish and speaks in broken English. He's a kind of interesting character to me, partly for that reason, the way that Algren lends him a kind of articulateness of thought, because he's a very undignified character. He's basically just kind of run around and literally then out the window by the end of the novel,
right?
And Solly's coming in when he's at work to sleep with his wife, then out into the street, and there's the the two neighborhood cops, and then there's the captain in the precinct who starts the novel, who also features in one of those stories in The Neon Wilderness, The Captain Has Bad Dreams, which gets reworked into a couple of different scenes in The Man with the Golden Arm. But Captain Bednar is a very interesting figure because he sits there at the beginning of the novel and all of these habitual criminals are put up in front of him and he's booking them one by one. And he's kind of punished by their vagary, I guess is a way of putting it, and can't quite understand why. And as the novel goes on, you don't see a lot of him, but at the end, Algren really kind of damns him. And the thing that Bednar gets damned for is that he doesn't actually care about these people. It's a really weird, interesting moment that I noticed when I was reading through it, that he cries these crocodile tears that, let me see if I can find it. So he's haunted by these crimes and criminals that come up in front of him. Then in the middle of the novel, he has to book in a defrocked priest who says to him, "You still preach pretty good when it comes to cashing phony checks. What were you defrocked for? Because I believe we are all members of one another." That stopped the captain cold. He studied the wreck as if suddenly so uncertain of himself that he was afraid to ask what he had meant by that. "I don't get it," he acknowledged at last, and passed on with greater confidence to a little heroin head, batting his eyes and coughing the little dry addict's cough politely into his palm. He gets haunted by that line, "We are all members of one another." And it's the defrocked preacher, a priest, is saying this. This is a, you know, Algren's theology, I suppose we might call it, is that, yeah, that the church isn't going to provide your morality. The cop isn't going to provide your morality. The neighborhood has its kind of morality that has to be found in the ways in which these people live their lives. We are all members of one another. And the captain doesn't get that. Everyone else in the novel gets that. And they know when they're betraying it. So Sully sells out Frankie twice in this novel. And that's one of the real heartbreakers. It's like a lot of the novel gets focused on the loveless marriage between Frankie and his wife, Sosh, and then the love between him and Molly, the girl who hustles drinks at the bar across the street and is a stripper and a prostitute and everything. And that's the love that's going to save him, but it can't. But actually, I think the platonic love between him and Sully, this thief, and the fact that they rely on one another, and then when one of them sells the other out is when it really goes wrong, it's very heartbreaking because it ruins them both and they both know it.
Yeah.
And they both acknowledge it to themselves and are defenseless against it. But the captain, to come back to my point, what the captain doesn't understand at the end, he's described as crying crocodile tears for these people because he doesn't see himself as a member of them. He sees himself behind that mirror, behind that microphone in the station, as someone apart right. from it, even though he's every bit a member of the neighborhood as they are.
Right. So Bednar would be what I guess would in the book and the terms of the time, he was one of the squares.
Yeah.
Right. So Bednar is kind of on the, I guess, the front line, so to speak. And they have the requisite lineup scene, which of course Algren uses the device in several of his works. And it's a great device because you basically get this kind of cross section of, you know, small time thievery and the idea that each one of the people that's presented in the lineup has the spotlight on them one at a time, mm-hmm. and each of them is guilty of something, right? And the point I think that needs to be made is that, of course, we're all guilty of something. And they, of course, have to face it in front of an audience. There's not only Bednar, but there's also this in the scene in Golden Arm, there's this background of spectators.
Yeah.
Of course, back in the day, you could go in and actually, and Algren did this, you could go in and watch the lineups. I don't think you didn't even need to be part of a crime. It was an open, I think there was some way you could actually get in to the station.
At one time, you had to have a ticket that said you were a victim of a crime. And I think he talks about this somewhere where he got robbed at some point and he kept the ticket so he could keep mm-hmm. going back as though he was going to like identify the assailant or something, but he just used it so he could go and use it as a spectator sport, I suppose. That's a bit unkind to him.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he's a writer, so yeah. he's using it for research. A purpose. So, but the point there, Yeah. So the point in the book in that scene is that he describes them laughing in a very non-human, non-feeling way, very distant, disconnected way. So that essentially it's the idea of laughing at the misfortunes of these folks. And there's no, he mentions there's, it's not real laughter.
Yeah.
None of these people are having real laughter. Bednar is not having real feelings. He's disconnected. Bednar's from the neighborhood, so he knows these, and he knows these people. He knows these thieves, probably these small time criminals. He knows them better than probably anybody else because he sees them all the time. And the whole thing, I think it really hits on the question of, okay, what is he doing with his life? It's an existential question. What do you, are you actually doing something to help these people? What's the point of policing? Aldrin doesn't get into all those details, but it's kind of
well. One of the things I think is really impressive about Aldrin in this novel more than his others, I think, is that in this novel, all of that question is direct. Like, what is the point of these policing? What is the point of this official society? What is the point of this culture? Is always there, but it's so much at the edge of the novel that you, it's not the focus. The focus is these people who are living the consequences of those things. And it just gets a passing, you know, so the novel starts with Bednar, as we've been talking about. You get some mentions of the ward super and the election year that's coming. So Frankie, pretty early on in the novel, kills his drug dealer who's basically taunting him. There's a bit more to it than that, but no one really cares until it starts becoming an election liability. And the ward supervisor needs to clean it up so he can get reelected. And so Frankie becomes a political consequence. And it's just in there, it's just as part of the fabric. It starts to drive the plot a bit more towards the end. But the way in which that it becomes suffocating, all those power structures become suffocating to these people who actually do care about one another, who fight with each other and are mean to each other. But ultimately, you see that all those, you know, back to your New Year's Eve party, everyone who mattered was there. They actually matter to each other. Bednar's not at the New Year's Eve party because he doesn't matter.
Right.
He doesn't recognize them as members of him and himself as members of them like that priest does. And the way that those balances go so delicately through this novel is it's an astonishing, I think, from my point of view, it's an astonishing feat of writing to have created these characters, to have set their relationships so delicately together in such a complicated and meaningful way.
Yeah, the way that the story develops is interesting to me, just been rereading it. It's a slow-moving novel at first, and it's rich in character and in exposition with the scenery, and it's absolutely, in rereading, I thought this is absolutely genius, is the way that this develops. I mean, the actual plot moves fairly quickly once it actually moves, but that's not really the point necessarily. It's the impression of the characters, what position they're in life, getting back to the existentialist aspect, which he also dealt in with the novel Never Come Morning, where these folks are in essentially a trap, you know, they're trapped in poverty and their options are few, at least their foreseeable options. As a third party observer, as a reader, you're thinking, well, why can't they get out of this? Why don't they just leave the neighborhood? Why doesn't Frankie get away from the situation? Why doesn't he just leave his wife?
Yeah.
And those are easy solutions for anybody else to say, of course, but not so easy for the character themselves.
So it's explicitly dealt with a few times, like Vi in particular, who wants to leave her husband but relies on his pension. And she keeps trying to save up money to divorce him. But as soon as she saves up a bit, then she spends it and she's just stuck in this impoverished cycle. And by the end of the novel, she's moved in with the landlord as her solution. So she, like, literally, she tries to leave. She can't leave. She ends up consolidating with the one guy who's definitely not going anywhere because he owns the building.
Right.
So you mentioned Never Come Morning, and there's a lot of parallels between the novels. They're set in the same neighborhood as part of it, but you know, Frankie dream, his one dream is becoming a drummer, and he's apparently a good drummer. It's kind of hard to tell, but he actually can drum. It's not just some made up thing in his mind. But like in Never Come Morning, Bruno Bicek wants to leave the neighborhood by becoming a boxer, and he's a good boxer and a good baseball player, but like he dreams it without really focusing on creating it, and also it doesn't have the opportunity or the money to put himself in a position to create it.
Right. And in the long run, those are fairly, you know, high risk. You know.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. It's not like everybody is going to be, all right, Gene Krupa.
Gene Krupa, yeah. So, or Rocky Marciano or whatever.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So there's no other, you know, practical. It's either, you know.
They haven't been to the career guidance counselor at school.
right. Yeah, so I mean, even like, yeah, they Algren touches on it a little bit with Frankie's background. I thought it was interesting. So Sophie has, you know, a good Polish education where she at least got through, like, I think, ninth grade.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. Never graduated high school, but it's a good Polish education.
Yeah.
And I think Frankie didn't even get that far.
He's like sixth grade education or something.
Something like that. Foster parents, I believe.
Yeah.
You know, Sophie had a mother and a father, and it seems like she had kind of a, I guess you'd call it a lower working class, you know, home that she came from, which it was much nicer than Frankie's background.
Yeah.
And once again, in the kind of hierarchy of the neighborhood, you know, Frankie's one of the generalized term is punk. Yeah. He's a punk from the neighborhood. He's basically he's going to be trouble, right? I mean, he doesn't have a skill set to speak of. Went into the service, and I guess he got a Purple Heart. That's something that kind of comes out of that. So he has some sense of, I guess, commitment, loyalty, and bravery, but courage, but never comes out of that with any skill set, but ends up being hooked on morphine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the classic. The classic thing, I guess, what we're looking at it too, is that it's more of the high-level angle is that here you have a post-war American novel where the hero, quote unquote, is he's a war veteran who comes back a junkie.
Yeah,
I mean, it's so anti-hero and so really anti-American. That's what I think one of the things that makes the novel so great.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out that this is not something that anyone had really written about in this way before Algren.
Right. And it won the National Book Award in 1949, which was amazing in and of itself, because also you had an America that just before McCarthyism, it seemed was willing to look at itself and its social problems and really self-introspect to the point where we haven't even got, maybe in the 60s we had this a bit, but certainly not today.
No.
I mean, we're back to a different America. So that fact was always intriguing to me, was, you know, the particular angle. And there certainly wasn't any other point of view like that in American literature at the time. Later on, you had the Beats, a bit different, but
similar generation to Frankie Machine, which is kind of interesting because a lot of those guys came back from the from the war. Not necessarily, they didn't come back as junkies necessarily, but they did come back damaged by. You know, I think of damage by war experience is what I was going to say there. And I sometimes think when I'm reading this novel about like Hell's Angels, who are also guys who came back from the Second World War addicted to drugs that they were given to, you know, they're all speed freaks because they were feeding them speed so they could keep fighting. And, and the damage that it causes those soldiers, and which is not, again, not something that was widely written about. In those terms, in the terms that Algren's taking them on.
I think one thing that we should hit on is the theme of guilt.
I was just about to say that word, yeah.
Okay. So the theme of guilt. So you have, there's several layers of this and angles, but so you have the guilt, which Algren describes so well. Actually, I wanted to read this. The great secret and special American guilt of owning nothing, nothing at all. In the one land where ownership and virtue are one, guilt that lay crouched behind every billboard which gave each man his commandments, for each man here had failed the billboards all down the line. No Ford in this one's future, nor ever any place all his own, had failed before the radio commercials, by the streetcar plugs, and by the standards of every self-respecting magazine. That's so good. That's so classic, Algren. And he of course, goes back to those themes in his essays, Chicago City and the Make, and of course, Nonconformity, mm-hmm. which didn't get published until Dan Simon pulled it out of the archives and published it, I think, in 94, which is a great kind of critique on America of the 50s, but also holds true today quite clearly. It's kind of Algren's, as Burk Horvath says, Algren's State of the Union.
Yeah.
And certainly holds true today. But so there's the guilt of really not being middle class American, mm-hmm. you know, that is something that's a real thing. I mean, through propaganda, especially commercials, as he mentions, in the billboards, so to speak, in the radio ads. But with us today, yeah, if you don't own a home in America, if you don't have a car, you don't have this and that, then you're nobody, right? What would you be doing? What kind of American are you? So the guilt of not keeping up with the Joneses, so to speak, not keeping up with what you're supposed to do in terms of a consumer. One of the special and unique components of the novel is that there's the kind of societal view, and then there's also, there's the environmental influence on the characters, especially Frankie, and then there's the tragedies of that are their own doing, their own responsibility. The guilt, essentially, of not living up to your higher self, not even coming close. You know, the guilt of not truly trying to kick the drug habit or not taking care of yourself to the point of, you know, allowing this other guilt over his wife. Okay. So Sophie, they had a car accident. Frankie was drunk driving, runs into a light pole. That's a whole great scene, by the way. And,
can I just interrupt you for a second? Because that scene is great. Because he smashes the car into the light pole, and then immediately after it, there's this great moment where he decides he needs a stick of gum to cover his breath, and these two girls hustle him.
Right.
These two little 10-year-old girls hustle him first. So he said, "I'll give you a nickel if you give me a stick of gum," and they give him this old, unwrapped, linty piece of gum that they hustle a dime out of him for. It's really like, it's all Algren, the comedy is always so interwoven and such a part of the texture. Sorry, I just had to like footnote that.
Oh, absolutely. And then the two young girls are chewing, like he describes them as calves chewing on their
it's cup. Juicy fruit. It's hard to get these days, they tell him.
Right. And they warn it with so good. They're so street smart. You got these, you know, these young, innocent girls. And, oh, don't worry, mister. The cop is, I can't remember the exact quote, but the cop is already stewed. Yeah. And you have to have a wallet. And it's like, so they know the rules of the game, and they're like 8, 9 years old. So the guilt of not living up to your better self or not. And with Sophie, she's uses the dynamics, their relationship is interesting as well. Mm-hmm. This kind of power play that happens between in a couple. I think Aubrey describes it fairly well, where Frankie never really fell for Zosh like she wanted. Yeah. She wanted the man to really be in love with her, like she was in love with him. And he basically just kind of, you know, it seemed like it was the easiest thing for him to be with her. He was very dominant personality. And then when she loses control, she brings that control back after the accident by essentially faking her disability and making Frankie feel guilty for the accident every day of his life. So the idea that the character has this vulnerability, right? And she knows that he has a vulnerability to guilt, and she's taking total advantage of it. That's one of the things. As a reader, you're thinking, you know, it is in some ways it is very, it's uncomfortable reading some of the, you feel tortured in some ways. But what's so great about Algren, it's almost like, okay, sit down, have a drink at the bar with me while I tell this story, and we unravel this tragedy.
The thing with Sophie is really interesting, because there's a maybe three or so fairly long passages that focus on her. So you talked earlier about how slowly the novel accumulates over the first part in particular, that there's not a lot of plot happening. And it really does just sort of shifts from character to character in quite smooth ways. One of them comes in and then it lingers on them. And in fact, I'm just going to, there's a critic called George Bluestone who in his essay about Ahlgren says that these digressions are the point of Ahlgren, that the lingering on these characters and giving them their due is the point, which ties back into what we were saying earlier about the empathy and so on. And we are members of each other. But with Sophie, it's really interesting because in each of these long passages of her looking out the window and thinking about how lousy her life is, she always starts to veer towards reflecting in a kind of honest way on how she's put herself in this situation. Because she has put herself in this situation. She's faking her injuries. And as soon as she gets close to it, she pivots away and starts blaming other people for not helping her. You know, oh, Vi didn't even come by to help me today, or Vi came by later, or didn't stay as long as she should have, and or Frankie's no good. He's doing, you know, he put me here. And it's she wants to be honest with herself, and then the truth starts to look a bit too unkind to her, and she pushes herself away from it. And the reason one of the reasons I'm lingering on this, and I find interesting, is that it's also a parallel to Never Come Morning. In Never Come Morning, she's always talking about how people are cheating her. In right. Never Come Morning, the guy, the barber who kind of runs the hoodlums gang out the back of his barbershop, Boniface, he's always talking about how people are cheating him. And he's possibly Ahlgren's nastiest character. I think he's even nastier than Blind Pig and Nifty Louie in Golden Arm. And he deals himself fake hands, imaginary hands of cards, and then gets mad when the fake imaginary characters are cheating him from the fake thing that he's doing. And he's so twisted up by his own sense of paranoia. But he's similar. He has this obsession with being cheated and doesn't face truthfully who he is and how he has operated himself. It has different consequences and different textures to it than Sophie. But it's interesting that Ahlgren focuses on these secondary characters with this particular thematic idea and how carefully he shows them denying their own character. Because other characters in Ahlgren
right.
have similar problems. And some of them are more honest about who they are and others aren't.
Right. Studs Terkel mentioned this when we interviewed him for a documentary, that quite often it's what's not said.
Yeah.
And that's what's so interesting in how this story unfolds. It's not really plot driven, it's character driven. And it's how the character, Sophie, for instance, always focusing. I mean, it seems like, you know, there's this nostalgic love of the past. And you realize, you know, you start to, as you get to know the character more, you realize, well, she really did have a nice life. She was one of the hot gals in the neighborhood. You know, and Frankie and her were quite the couple. They were a handsome couple and they did exciting and fun things. And as it, you know, what happens, you know, the contemporary, you know, time that everything has fallen apart and she's bitter and blames everybody else around her. And I guess the thing that's interesting too is that, okay, how many writers are going to concentrate on that person as a character? And the fact of the matter is, how many of people in our own lives do we know that are like that? I have to say there's quite a few. I mean, it's very common to have Sophies, mm-hmm. and male or female, to pay attention to that perspective in life. And you realize, this has happened to a lot of people. And the way he describes her time alone, she's trapped in the room, in her wheelchair, it certainly suggested that she can get up and walk around. But I guess in the long run, you don't know how much ability she really does have. Part of it is a mental mm-hmm. thing. But just that there's the beauty in the tragedy. I mean, the beauty in the loneliness and how he describes the lighting and the cityscape. And he really captures that neighborhood so well. I mean,
maybe
just,
that's
absolutely spot
maybe
on.
Maybe that's something we could just turn to as a way of drawing up our conversation a bit, is the descriptions of the neighborhood. I mean, this novel barely leaves Division Street. It does a little bit, but not very much. And the descriptions of the city mostly, I think, manifest themselves in the arc lights and the L. These two images just recur and recur. And have a really interesting effect. It creates a, I think the lights in particular, he's always talking about the edges of the arc, you know, the lights thrown by the arc lights. And it gives it a kind of, I'm resisting saying melancholy because it is melancholic, but it's not just melancholy. And the L becomes a real, it creates claustrophobia. It's like the train is like a barrier to them rather than something that takes them somewhere. It's always rushing past.
Right. That's a good
point. It flutters like Molly's apartment. We haven't even really talked much about Molly, but Frankie goes to visit her in her apartment downstairs, and it's so close to the train tracks that when the train is half a mile away, the curtains start to flutter. And this image of the fluttering curtains becomes a kind of comfort to him and becomes then a kind of nostalgic thing quite quickly when he's not going to be able to go back to that apartment. But the train is always coming past, and it's always circumscribing them, I think is maybe the word for it. The shadows of the tracks, the trains themselves.
Right. In Never Come Morning, he describes Bruno Bajcik as a young boy growing up underneath the train tracks, as others would have grown up underneath trees.
Yeah.
So this industrial world, and this is something too, I think, well, you know, in the long run, it's probably what, you know, it's one of the aspects about Algren's writing and any of the people of his time period, that, you know, describing this urban landscape, which was, you know, fairly, by today's standards, it was fairly new, right? I mean, maybe 20, 30 years in, maybe 40 years in with the cars, the traffic, trolley cars, also, of course, the automobiles, and then certainly the noise of the L. I mean, anybody who's lived in a city with a train like that, you know that it's such an ongoing presence in your life. But just think about the fact that part of your life, I mean, you're living your life in this city where you're so used to having this immense presence with the noise and the pollution and just the reverberation. It's a part of nature, in a sense, of the city. And Algren does, and in the lighting, he does that in all his writing. He's so attentive to the, especially the, I guess he kind of compares and contrasts that quite a bit. He uses the street lights and the neon lights, the artificial, the man-made lights, or, you know, the industrial lighting, as opposed to, you know, what would have been historically, you know, any writer's description would be, of course, nature.
Well, in fact, he talks about the moon
falls on nature, but,
and the moon doesn't move, and then Sophie gets fixated on the moon, and if the moon would just move, but it doesn't move, it's stationary, and then I think at another point it does move, and she wants it to be still, like she, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is like
it's like a paper
moon.
Paper moon.
You know, nature isn't really, doesn't have a place here. The cities replace it. It occurred to me while you were
It's first. It's
yeah. And it occurred to me while you were talking about that in most of the other novels, or a lot of other novels around this time, or before this time, Chicago novels. I'm thinking of things like Native Son or The Jungle, Sister Carrie, and even Studs Lonergan. Like the characters live in a particular neighborhood, but there's always some point in the novel where they go to the rich part of town. So in Native Son, I mean, he gets employed by the rich people. In The Jungle, there's a scene where Jurgis goes to the rich guy's, the son sort of takes him home with him. And he's in this millionaire's mansion on the north side. And Studs Lonergan, they sometimes, you know, they go down to town and they walk through richer neighborhoods to make fun of the rich people and stuff. In Algren, they don't even see that world. Their world is still just this street and just these lights and their shadows and just these.
Yeah, just that block.
It's one block of Division Street where everybody matters.
Right. That's a good point. And even to some degree, that's still an issue in certain Chicago neighborhoods where young people don't even really get out, you know, beyond their neighborhood and explore, for instance, the art museum or a library downtown or something like that. But so there's that claustrophobic feeling of entrapment, not only in the neighborhood, but of course the metaphorical entrapment of the, you know, the social hierarchy of the neighborhood. I think for Algren and other writers of the time period, I think visual artists, I think it would be Edward Hopper, I think was a big influence on them. And also there was the advent of, you know, photography as art, and some of the photographers that worked in the, you know, part of the WPA projects. There's a photographer that was very similar, and a few of them were doing similar work to Hopper, where they would show that the beauty in the urban landscape and, you know, how natural sunlight falls on these, you know, industrial objects and in our tenement dwellings and whatnot. And Algren is all about this, of course. There's, of course, the what we consider the standard beauties of the city, but it's the alleys, of course, that you have to love as well. And there's the beauty in the ugliness, so to speak, the beauty and the tragedy, the beauty, not only in the visual, but also, of course, in the stories of people's lives. So, yeah, there's a visual kind of tandem there, visual connection between the lives of the people and their stories and the environment that they live in.
Yeah, absolutely. That might be a good place to leave our conversation. Thank you very much for joining me to talk about The Man with the Golden Arm, Mark Blattner.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Total pleasure.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the American Centrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.